Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation. With a new partnership, you can now find C-section and other maternity care ratings for your local hospital on Yelp.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we find out why Airbnb is growing increasingly popular in some mountain communities near Yosemite, and why it's pitting neighbor against neighbor. We'll also find out why some say pharmacists could be a partial solution to the Valley's doctor shortage. And we'll hear from Congressman David Valadao talking about why he opposes the ending of the DACA program. We begin, though, with the cause of all that smoke that has filled the Valley in recent days. It was a terrible weekend in the central and southern Sierra for wildfires. In the mountains to the south of Yosemite, 6 wildfires are currently burning, with 2 new ones sparked on Sunday alone, threatening homes and forcing hundreds to evacuate. And it's not just Mariposa and Madera counties. Further south in Tulare County, the Pier Fire continues to threaten communities near the Tule River from Springville to Camp Nelson. That fire has burned nearly 18,000 acres and is just 10% contained. But a lot of the focus over the last 2 days has been in Madera County, where the Mission Fire and the Railroad Fire have been especially difficult. Mark Evans Smith with the Sierra Star joins us now to bring us up to date. Mark, welcome.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks for having me.
I want to start with the Mission Fire. This one popped up on Sunday near North Fork, and Sunday afternoon was just a really, really terrible time. Take us back to that point and up to where we are today. Where did this fire begin? Let's put it that way.
It's basically right in a community called Cascadel Heights, which is in the Cascadel Woods area, which is a couple miles, about 2 miles east of North Fork. And this fire, Cascadel has been known to have some of the highest tree mortality rates in the area. About 90% plus of all the pines out there are considered dead. And so this fire, and the cause is still under investigation, just absolutely exploded. Within hours, it was up to like 350 acres. There were people just trying to get out as quick as possible. At least 5 homes were destroyed by today's update. And in fact, that day, that Sunday, there were about 50 people who were confirmed as trapped in the area. They couldn't get out because I believe one of the exit roads, and there aren't a lot of good roads in there. They're real narrow, real broken up, and so they couldn't get out. But fortunately, the Madera County Sheriff's Office really worked hard to get them all out of the area safely. So there's been no reported deaths or injuries or anything like that. So we can't thank everybody, firefighters, sheriffs, everyone really working hard out there right now.
Now, almost at the same time as the Mission Fire, another fire sparked west of Ahwahnee, south of Bootjack, in that area, in that overall foothill area around Oakhurst, the Peak Fire. What happened there?
So with the Peak Fire, fortunately, that one's been a little bit easier on everybody, I guess, if you could call it that. And I forgot to give you for the Mission Fire this morning. It's 875 acres, 8% contained. Good progress was made overnight thanks to high humidity and low temperatures and everything like that. But with the Peak Fire now, it started near Usona Road and Indian Peak. And again, that one's under investigation too. Not sure how that started. But it's at 680 acres now. It's 50% contained, and Usona Road has been reopened to residents in the area. The areas of Bronco Hollow and River Haven, little community areas there, remain under evacuation, though, because they still got to, clear out all the flames that are still threatening a lot of structures in there.
Now, there's been an absolutely massive response to the Railroad Fire. This one sparked last week along the Sugar Pine Railroad, right on Highway 41, and that prompted evacuations of Fish Camp, closed the southern entrance into Yosemite, the Tenaya Lodge, and has really caused great concern. What's the latest with the railroad fire? Has it died down at all? Is it improving there, that situation?
Well, I just spoke to an information officer with the interagency management team that's looking over the railroad fire, and he said they're expressing cautious optimism about the situation. It's looking better than it has in previous days. Again, the high humidity and low temperatures are just an they're a real big help to all the firefighters and everyone out there. But so it hasn't grown as significantly as in previous days. So it's at 10,734 acres. It's 23% contained, the same as previous days. And there's some good news, too. Fish Camp, the evacuations there, or at least the highway and everything, was reopened in the Mariposa County line with Madera County up to Yosemite National Park yesterday evening. So people are going to be allowed to return home. Tenaya Lodge, a real popular resort up there, I put in a call to them this morning, and they said they're hopeful that they can reopen tomorrow. They've had staff working there throughout the duration of the inferno to keep that resort safe. And so I would say that overall things are looking better, but, you know, I was talking to the same information officer from the interagency team, and he said fires are unpredictable. People, they're cautiously optimistic that things are looking better, that temperatures are going to drop over the next few days. But at the same time, you just can't say where flames are going to go or if homes are going to be lost or anything like that. I will say, for anyone listening, he did mention that the area of Sugar Pine is where the fire is closest right now. But he said things are looking good. They haven't had any additional structural damage from previous days. Fish Camp is looking good. And, yeah, so lots of good progress being made out there by all those hardworking firefighters and sheriff's deputies and volunteers, Caltrans. And we can't thank them enough. It's been a real chaotic time lately, but they're really doing a lot out there.
What about the Nelder Grove of giant sequoias? I know that you did some reporting on that over the weekend as the fire moved into the grove. What do we know about that right now? Do we know if those trees, giant sequoias, have lived with fire for millennia, but they are not fireproof? What do we know about the status there?
From what I've heard, these ancient trees, some that have lived more than 2,500 years, are still alive. They're still there. They made it through. The fire has spread through the grove pretty deeply. Like, it's really burned through a lot of brush and everything. And some folks who've been there their whole lives, effectively, were saying they were worried about these ancient trees because, yes, they are fire resistant and they actually thrive in fire on a fairly regular basis. But because there's a lot of built up vegetation in there, they were worried that the flames were going to get too hot and actually damage the trees. There are some ancient sequoias that have died there because of fire. But from what I understand, from what I've heard, they're still safe. Things are looking good. Some firefighting crews were able to also protect some historic cabins that are in there. They wrapped the cabins in what I believe is kind of like a foil-type material to protect them from being burned as well. So it's been looking pretty good in there despite the constant anxiety or worry, I guess, of, you know, these ancient trees that have outlived the beginning and end of entire nations were under threat. And so a lot of us up here were really worried when that was happening. But again, it's looking good.
How taxed are firefighting resources right now? There was a point on Sunday when the Mission fire sparked in Cascadel there that I know that the air tankers were all on a no divert status, meaning if they were planning to go to somewhere else, they had to. Number one priority was that area with all these other fires going on simultaneously. How taxed are resources right now?
Oh, I can't even begin to imagine how exhausted all these firefighters are right now. But again, they never give up. They keep working. There, from yesterday, there were, I believe, 7,500 plus firefighters working on 25 blazes throughout the state. There's fires everywhere, and they're trying to get as much resources to each one as possible. The cause of the no divert order on the mission fire was because, from what I understand, there was an immediate threat to human life. And so when that happens, they have to call in everything that they can. They can't divert stuff to any other fire because the number one priority is always human safety, both civilian and for firefighters and deputies and everyone like that. And then after that is structure, safety, and everything. So, yeah, it's been chaotic for them. And I can't imagine how exhausted they all are. But, again, they're just giving it their all, and they refuse to quit. And, again, from all of us who live up here near where these fires are happening, pretty close to us, we can't thank them enough. It's a worrisome time, but, you know, you get used to it up here sometimes in the summers because it's part of mountain life, and so we'll just try and help as much as we can.
Before we go, we just have a few minutes left. The global supertanker, this is the 747 Boeing jetliner that has been converted into an air tanker, the largest in the nation, and just recently put into service after it got its state and federal certification. I understand it's been used already several times here in this area.
That's correct. Last week it was used on the railroad fire when it was first in its initial stages. I believe on Thursday is when it arrived. And then on Sunday, it was also called in on the mission fire. So this big old bird, as I like to call it, drops about 18,500 gallons of retardant, which is about 1.7 times what the next largest air tankers can drop. And so it does have its effectiveness. I was speaking to Deputy Chief of CAL FIRE, and he was telling me that they're evaluating how effective it is because the new plane, it was certified for use last week on Monday. And so it does give them the ability to make these large drops in one run that can be helpful. But, you know, they're figuring it out and seeing how good it's working compared to some other tankers that are smaller and can't drop as much but have better maneuverability, especially in these hilly areas where they have to fly up and down these hillsides. So, yeah, it's definitely been a sight to see. When you see that thing come overhead, you know it's there. It's a big old plane, and it certainly makes an impact.
And how are residents faring in all of this? Have you been able to talk to any of them yet? I know evacuations have been in a state of flux in and out. We get one note saying the Red Cross is closing its evacuation shelter in Oakhurst, and then a few hours later, they're reopening it because there's a new fire, those sorts of things. Have you talked to any of the people who have been affected by the fire?
Just a few. I've been talking mostly with people as we've reported our stories, people have been commenting on them and letting us know what they're thinking. And I guess it's just hard to say. I mean, one resident that we spoke to, I didn't speak to her directly, but we do have these stories, all sorts of stories on these fires on our website, sierrastar.com. But she was telling us she was evacuated and at the shelter, and she said that she was worried about her home. She didn't know if it was still there, but she kind of came to accept that this was part of life up here. And it is scary. It does get very scary sometimes, and people worry a lot, but I don't know. I think mainly they just hope for the best for firefighters and everything. And even when we've had some reports that some homes being lost, people have already been setting up fundraising websites and everything for the families that have been affected. So people really rally here. There's kind of a communal spirit and togetherness and just a sort of unified strength that really helps bring good morale in these trying times.
Mark Evan Smith, reporter with the Sierra Star, following all of these wildfires burning in the mountains of Mariposa and Madera counties. And we will continue to follow all of those fires, including the Pier Fire in Tulare County as well. You can tune into this station, and you can also find those reports from Mark online at sierrastar.com. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much, Joe. I hope all's well down there in the valley.
All right. We continue now in the mountain communities just south of Yosemite with another look at an issue in the news, and that's tourism. And where do all those tourists go? Last year, over 5 million people visited Yosemite National Park, and all of those tourists need places to stay. With few hotels in the region, they're turning to short-term rental sites like Airbnb more and more each year. And as FM89's Ezra David Romero reports, while some say that's boosting the local economy, in some cases, it's also pitting neighbor against neighbor.
Most people in the mountain area around Oakhurst know Katie Miller as the Mountain Madam. That's her brand. The London Properties realtor and I are driving to an area north of Oakhurst where she recently sold a home that's now listed on Airbnb.
That's the Airbnb right here. There's a spiral staircase inside, all wood floors. They figured out how to maximize the space and put beds everywhere.
Miller says the short-term rental market in the area has skyrocketed over the past 2 years. One of her clients recently bought a property with a cabin and a creek on it.
His wife came in like the day before we closed, looked at what she needed for the area, went to Fresno, bought brand new stuff, and boom, it was an Airbnb the next day.
Miller says this buyer is just one of many people she's working with that are purchasing homes for the sole purpose of using them as short-term rentals. She says this has created a housing shortage in the region and that property managers in the area have growing wait lists.
The short-term rentals have basically taken over our regular rentals market. So we have walk-ins every day. They're not looking to purchase a home. They're just looking for some avenue to help them find a rental, and we have nothing to provide them with.
Miller says it's almost easier to buy a home here than to find a long-term rental. There are 300-plus short-term rentals in Madera County. The bulk are concentrated along the route to Yosemite and vacation destinations like Bass Lake. If the trend continues, up to 100 new short-term rentals could be added to the area next year. It's great for a region with few industries and jobs, but for some cases, it's dividing neighbors who don't want to see their communities change. Others say the lack of long-term rentals could increase homelessness. Rhonda Salisbury with the Yosemite Madera County Visitors Bureau says all the short-term rentals serve as a huge economic boost to the region.
It opens up a whole new world for families vacationing, and it allows people to buy second homes because now they can rent them out, you know, and pay for the home. It's really boosted a lot of economies.
Former Madera County Supervisor Gary Gilbert lives in a subdivision between the communities of Oakhurst and North Fork. He and I are driving to see a two-story short-term rental, two houses away from his ranch-style property.
Make a left?
Yeah, make a left. That's your vacation rental right there on the end.
Gilbert doesn't like the idea of his neighbors changing regularly and says residential areas like the one he lives in aren't zoned for businesses.
We did not know it was a short-term rental. Nobody notified us. There was no review. All of a sudden, we started noticing people walking around, families, dogs. Who are these people?
With constant visitors and absentee owners, he says more should be required from both the county and homeowners renting out the properties.
What I'd like to see is the county first zone the property correct, notify the public what's occurring. At the same time, county staff would inspect that facility. Does it have adequate water? Does it have adequate parking?
In an area called Cascadel Heights near North Fork, it's gotten so bad that a resident is suing her neighbor over a short-term rental. Chris Hamilton's attorney, Walt Whelan, says she's suing Marie Iden because she doesn't like the idea of not knowing who's staying in the secluded neighborhood of 17 homes.
They're concerned about transient uses in their subdivision. I mean, for a whole list of reasons, that particular subdivision is a high fire risk area. There have been instances in the last couple of years where the whole residential subdivision has been evacuated because of fire hazards.
According to Whelan, the home of the woman suing was burned down this week in the Mission fire that threatened at least 200 homes and burned hundreds of acres. Neither of the defendant's two homes were burned by the fire, and neither homeowner would speak with me on the record because the lawsuit is still ongoing. Still, Mark Stamas, who lives down the road, has watched the whole thing go down. He says for the lawsuit to continue is trivial because the neighborhood recently voted to not allow short-term rentals in its list of covenants, conditions, and restrictions.
Yeah, it's neighbor warring against neighbor. There was never any effort to work it out, and it seems moot to me. to even move forward because the issue's a non-issue now.
But no matter the cause, the lawsuit helped bring the issue to the forefront in Madera County. Until recently, county code wasn't clear about the legality of short-term rentals. But earlier this summer, the county passed an ordinance that makes short-term rentals legal.
We just did not see the impact or the fear that some of the residents had. We just did not see it through our investigative work and looking at these complaints on those two homes up in North Fork.
That's Madera County's planning director, Matt Treber. Now, to rent a place out, the homeowner must file for a business license and pay a 9% transient occupancy tax. The county stands to make a lot of money from the tax, and the 600-room hotel industry in the region doesn't seem to mind the short-term rentals. Hotel operators in the area say they are often full and refer visitors to Airbnb when they're booked. And Carol Severe, who manages 40-plus short-term rentals in Bass Lake and Oakhurst, says that without short-term rentals, there would be fewer jobs in the region. She hires house cleaners, landscapers, and maintenance crews. The homes she manages rent from $600 to $7,000 a week.
It seems like the vacation rental homeowners take better care of their homes than the houses that are rented monthly, because you want it looking great every time somebody walks in.
Cool. So this is like the living area?
Yes, we have a main living area with a very large couch for up to 10 people.
One of those people benefiting from short-term rentals is housekeeper Arista Flanagan. She says it's given her consistent year-round work. She cleans three Airbnbs between Bass Lake and Oakhurst for a homeowner that lives in San Diego.
I can work 4 hours here where I'd have to work 8 hours at my other job to make the same pay. So for me, it's very nice because I have two little kids, so it's nice to be able to go home and not have to be away from them all day.
But while Flanagan is doing good, others are being hurt by the short-term rental economy shift and the housing shortage. And anyone who has lost a home in the region due to fire damage may also be looking for temporary housing. We'll hear their stories next week. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
This is Valley Edition. When most of us consider medical providers, what comes to mind may be doctors, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants. But what about pharmacists? A new law has allowed them to greatly expand their role to become providers, which could be good news for patients struggling to access doctors. But one major obstacle still stands in the way of pharmacists taking on patients. In the latest installment of our series, Struggling for Care, Carrie Klein brings us the story of a community pharmacist in Kern County looking to the future.
Behind the cash registers in an expansive blue-roofed pharmacy, two huge machines are whirring away, filling little plastic bottles with pills, tablets, and capsules of all sizes and colors.
These are robots, okay, autofill robots. This one has 200 drugs.
Brian Komodo is the CEO of Komodo Pharmacy in downtown Delano.
And so what happens is they want this prescription, they scan it, shows what the tablet should look like so they can compare, and then they cap it.
A pharmacist and entrepreneur, Komodo's worked hard to make his pharmacy stand out. He offers wheelchairs, walkers, and other aids that typically aren't available at retail pharmacies. And he was an early adopter of those fast-moving prescription-filling robots that improve efficiency behind the scenes.
We try to think of, you know, how do we raise our game? I want to be the Disneyland of pharmacy if I could.
Komodo is particularly excited about a new opportunity that could allow pharmacists across the state to up their game. Thanks to a law enacted in 2014, pharmacists have been upgraded from medical professionals to providers. Health leaders are excited about what this could mean for reducing the patient load of primary care doctors, but only once pharmacists overcome a major hurdle. At a basic level, Senate Bill 493 sets out to make better use of what many say is the most accessible healthcare practitioner out there. Virginia Harold, executive officer of the California Board of Pharmacy, says, "What other practitioner can you see in your neighborhood without an appointment, regardless of insurance?"
I think their role in the healthcare
field is tremendously underutilized, and it's not just what I'm saying, it's part of led to the enactment of SB 493.
Because of this law, pharmacists can now offer a handful of drugs without a prescription, including travel meds and immunizations, and it led to other laws that allow pharmacists to furnish birth control and the opioid overdose drug naloxone. With some more qualifications, pharmacists can also apply for a license to become what's called an advanced practice pharmacist. They can work more closely with patients to monitor diseases and help manage drug side effects and complications. Harold says SB 493 came about in response to the Affordable Care Act in anticipation of a run on doctors.
The whole point of having pharmacists involved in this is to help take care of some of the things that pharmacists are trained to do and to keep the primary care providers focused on the things that they are required and can do themselves, which is a far broader list of items.
If pharmacists can see patients for medication requests that would normally require a primary care appointment, this could ease doctors' patient loads. But it doesn't mean pharmacists can replace doctors. The goal is for pharmacists to play a more integral role in managing patients alongside other providers. Jennifer Toy is a professor at the UCSF School of Pharmacy and a pharmacist at Cahuilla Delta Medical Center in Visalia. She says many hospital-based pharmacists already have protocols that allow them to work in tandem with doctors and other providers.
They really think of us as a member of the team, but like a bridge. So let's say a physician has 15 minutes to see a patient for diabetes. Oh, but that physician's schedule is now full and can't see the patient for another month. A pharmacist can step in, has more time, 30 to 60 minutes at my clinic, and could see the patient every week until they see the physician again.
Some places poised to benefit most from this law are underserved areas, where there's typically fewer providers, fewer hospitals, and patients with a high burden of chronic disease. Stanley Snowden is a pharmacist at Community Regional Medical Center and a professor at California Health Science University's College of Pharmacy in Fresno.
I think definitely in areas where the physician shortage is harder hit than some other areas, such as the Central Valley, I think those are going to be probably the places that are most likely to be positively impacted.
But if you haven't heard of this expanded role for pharmacists, that's because it's not exactly being advertised. Lisa Kroon, chair of the Department of Clinical Pharmacy at UC San Francisco, says there's a bit of a problem.
One of our main barriers has been Medicare. So on the federal level, to be a prescribing provider, we are not recognized by Medicare or CMS, and that limits us in terms of billing for our professional services.
This is so new, pharmacists aren't yet paid for these services. They can't bill private insurance plans for them, and they can't get reimbursed by the government.
So it makes sense that in terms of providing the service, we need to get paid for it before you're going to see a large chain necessarily adopt it, but we're making progress.
A state law passed last year authorizes pharmacists to be reimbursed through Medi-Cal, but that can't go into effect until the state develops a policy proposal and gets it approved by the federal government. A state representative informed me it's likely their submission won't be ready until at least mid-2018. Simultaneously, two bills in Congress propose reimbursing pharmacists in medically underserved areas, but have not yet come to a vote. Meanwhile, local pharmacists are stepping up. Of the 45,000 or so pharmacists in the state, only about 150 have sought out advanced practice pharmacist licenses, which have been available since January. Six of those pharmacists are in the Valley. In fact, Kern is among the top 10 counties in the state for its number of advanced practice licenses, and Bakersfield has the same amount as San Francisco. One of those Kern County pharmacists works for Brian Komodo, who's already preparing for future pharmacy patients.
This is the area we were thinking we could use as a clinic.
Eventually, he thinks they'll have the space to take on two patients at a time, but only once his pharmacists can start getting paid for their work. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
And stay with us. We'll be back with more of Valley Edition in just a bit. We'll talk to Fresno City Councilmember Gary Bredefeld about his ongoing proposal that would have a City of Fresno employees allowed to carry concealed weapons, to carry guns at work. And we'll talk about the city's efforts to ban marijuana dispensaries. That, plus Congressman David Valadeo, coming up next on DACA. It's been a very busy first 8 months back on the Fresno City Council for Councilmember Gary Bredefeld. Last week, one of his major pieces of legislation passed in its first vote before the City Council, a ban on marijuana dispensaries in the city. Last week on our program, Bill McEwen joined us and said Bredefeld 2.0 in this go-around is a little different than Bredefeld 1.0 in his last version on the City Council over a decade ago. We invited the council member to join us today to talk about that and some of his other ideas. Gary, welcome.
Thank you so much.
First of all, starting out with the immediate news, how excited are you about the passage with the initial vote last Thursday on the marijuana sales ban in the city, given that the resolution got tweaked a little bit?
Well, I'm very pleased. I didn't support Prop 64. A lot of people didn't, but it passed. And people can obviously smoke marijuana. But we also had the right under Prop 64 to ban the dispensaries. And I think that was the correct move. Most cities in the Central Valley have done that. Fresno County's done that. City of Clovis has done it. We don't want these dispensaries. They draw crime. It's an all-cash business. It's my feeling that it would reduce the quality of life in neighborhoods wherever these dispensaries would go. And so I think it was the right decision, and I think it's going to improve our quality of life by not having these dispensaries in our city.
Now, under the prior regime, under medical marijuana, of course, those regulations are still in place, but the city had a ban on those dispensaries.
Yes,
but we know that many still operated in some fashion, and many delivery services still operated. Is this a matter of what's on the books versus what's in real life? Is there going to be a significant difference there still, do you think?
Well, you're right. There are some, as I'm told, illegal dispensaries that do operate. It really is up to our police department to enforce our ordinance and enforce our laws. But the fact that we have illegal dispensaries, to me, is not a reason to make legal dispensaries. We want to eradicate dispensaries, period, because they're a problem.
Given that a majority of California voters supported Prop 64 last November, and even in the city it gained support, do you think it would be prudent to look again in a few years and see how other cities that maybe didn't take a stance such as Fresno, the course that it's now on, that the ban not in place just yet, but to reevaluate in a few years and see what's working, maybe if the concerns that some people have, maybe they don't turn out to be true, or maybe looking at what other states that have done this. Have you looked at that, and would you be open to that?
Well, we're going to look at it. It's is part of the resolution was we would revisit this in a year. For me, I don't see how that would change. I mean, it's basically going to be a problem. Whether there's money that's made or not, it's still drug money as far as I'm concerned. It's just my own belief about it. There will be consequences, some unintended, as a result of any dispensaries that come into play. We're going to, as well as Prop 64. I mean, we're going to see people driving under the influence of marijuana. That will increase. There'll be traffic fatalities. All we have to do is look at Colorado and the state of Washington and see what happens there. We've seen in those states kids appearing in emergency rooms because they're eating edible marijuana. Often what passes sounds good. There are many unintended consequences, and they're going to be with Prop 64. However, people will look at this, and I'm sure there are many on the council and perhaps the mayor who also want to revisit it in a year, see what's happening. So we'll see.
So Councilmember Olivier tweeted out the other day, he said the city council has voted to begin this ban, but they also set in place its eventual repeal. How you've had some exchanges between the two of you, online and in council chambers. How do you respond to those claims and his opposition in large part to some of the things he proposed here?
Well, we affectionately call Councilman Olivier the Cannabis King of City Hall. He believes that any drugs ought to be legal. People ought to be able to do whatever they want with whatever substance they want. I don't share that view. The fact that there's a consultant, what I call a dope consultant, that the city's hiring up to $50,000 to me is an absolute waste of taxpayer money. We put this ban in place on the recreational dispensaries. I had my staff, the city, the mayor's staff look at it. We didn't need to hire a dope consultant to figure this out. Other cities do this. All we have to do is review what's going on in other communities. So I think this is a waste of money. And we'll see. I don't think this sets the repeal of anything in place. It basically will provide us additional more information. That's all.
So you've had a number of other big votes or big issues before the city council. Another one that was a big deal was the In God We Trust proposal that added those letters now to the wall behind the dais at City Hall, joining one of many of our other Valley cities, including yes. Bakersfield, where that campaign is really headed up by a council member there. That issue, coupled with some of the other things you've proposed, the proposal to allow city employees to, with concealed weapons permits, to carry their personal guns on the job. Bill McEwen last week said Gary Breidenfeld 2.0, and I'm paraphrasing sure, here, essentially sure. is a much more of a culture war warrior here than he was before. I think he said you were more of a Rockefeller Republican in your prior stint on the council over a decade ago. How did that comment sit with you, and how do you see how you've changed over the years?
Yeah, it didn't sit well with me, and I talked with Bill about that. Respect Bill McEwen tremendously, as most people do, but that's his perception. He's wrong. I wasn't a Rockefeller Republican at that time. I've always been a conservative. And I said, and I believe this, you know, 16 years later, coming back, it's not Gary Breidenfeld that's changed. Our society has changed, and I think in not in a good way. We have a number of things going on. We have police being attacked. We have the sexualization of our children through schools. We've taken God out of schools. We've become sanctuary cities, and we've weakened our criminal laws through Prop 47, Prop 57. We're now enacting legalizing marijuana and soon to be other drugs. I have no doubt. It was a 40-year effort in the state of California to legalize marijuana. They tried three times. The third time was the charm. I'm sure other drugs will follow. So yeah, I don't see that I've changed. I think society has changed. And, you know, I have the opportunity when these things come before the city council to speak out on them. I've never been shy. Bill knows that. And when I was an advocate, when I was on the council before, as he talked about, I fought hard to make sure that the impacts of development, because, you know, 20 years ago, development in Northeast, Northwest Fresno was much more prominent than it is today. A lot of it has been built out. You know, I stood up for the residents, and, you know, they asked me to stand up for them, and that's why I ran and stood up against very powerful developers and other forces out there, and wasn't shy about it, and I'm not shy today. He sees that somehow I've changed. I don't think I've changed at all. I'm very much the same person, and going to be a strong advocate for the people I represent. And sometimes, you know, when you stand up, you know, people don't like it, and some people disagree with you. And, you know, we live in a world of social media now that didn't exist 20 years ago. And so anybody can, you know, be at home and type on their keyboard and call you all kinds of names and do all kinds of things. But that doesn't deter me from doing what I think is right.
The proposal on guns did not gain the support of the council, at least it hasn't yet.
Well, yeah, we only discussed it. We never brought it for an action item. And the mayor and I have sat down and talked about this, excuse me, and we're still working on it.
How is the current policy inadequate? Because there are some city employees who have been granted authorization, I guess from the city manager, a special dispensation to carry a personal concealed weapon. And in fact, I understand some elected officials have done that as well. How is the current policy, if it allows that, inadequate?
Well, the fact is, Joe, there is no policy. There have been, as far as I know, what I call the well-connected or the politically elite who are able to carry weapons. As far as I know, there are no city employees beneath people who are actually on the executive wing that have been granted the opportunity to carry a concealed weapon. And there is no policy in place. That's a fallacy that there's a policy. The point I'm trying to make is let's get a policy in place and let's make it fair for everybody, people who aren't well-connected or elected. That isn't what's going on now. And there are people who have to go fix water mains at 2 o'clock in the morning in tough neighborhoods who have CCWs, who've called my office and said, hey, you know, I'd like to protect myself. I don't want to call the police to escort me. I'm not going to call the police. We have people who are in the crimes unit at the police department who are not sworn officers, who have CCWs, who would like to carry. And a lot of people don't know the man who shot the correctional officers had initially come to the police department and went through the back door and tried knocking on the door. They didn't let that person in. Those officers would have been shot. They weren't carrying weapons if they had let that guy in. So we don't have a policy in place, Joe. And this what I've talked about is people who have CCWs, and there's a whole process to get a CCW. From finger checks, background checks, federal checks, state checks, as well as making sure that you're proficient with a weapon. And I'm a strong, I don't just say I'm a strong Second Amendment supporter. I believe in it. And I believe that people have a right to carry. We live in a very dangerous time, very dangerous world. Prop 47 has weakened our criminal laws. You can now go into Walmart and steal up to $900 and they will escort you out the door. Well, as Police Chief Jerry Dyer says, I use this quote because it's an accurate one. What used to be a felony is a misdemeanor. What's a misdemeanor used to be a misdemeanor, now is an infraction. What used to be an infraction is legal. And that's a very dangerous thing that we're doing in our society, and certainly in California. And people have a right to protect themselves. Now, having said that, I understand that City of Fresno is an employer. And as most employers are, they're able to set standards in terms of if you allow somebody to carry. And so we're sitting down with the mayor and looking at trying to develop a fair policy for city employees. And there is no policy in place. That's the thing. That's not true that there's a policy. Again, as I
there's
said,
there's a practice, would you say?
Well, no, I didn't think there's a practice. I think there are certain people that are carrying because they have a CCW and they are either well connected or they're elected. That's it. And that's not fair. And people have a right to protect themselves and their lives, and you shouldn't be a special person because you're elected or well-connected. Your life is not any more valuable than anybody else's. And so there are certain city employees that I think ought to be able to carry because they are in certain situations where they could be harmed. Just as that maniac who killed three people downtown, one was a PG employee who was shot and killed in his truck. Should he have been able to have a weapon if he had a CCW? You know, I don't know. But I just know that we live in a very dangerous time and people have a right to protect themselves. And that's what the Second Amendment is all about to me.
And PG&E, as I understand it, does not allow employees CCW permits. One thing that I've heard brought up on that issue is that, you know, police officers go through a lot of training, de-escalation training,
sure,
about use of non-lethal force and how to avoid that encounter. Right now, concealed weapons permit holders receive a lot of training about their firearms and firearms use and those things. But what about that issue? Are we potentially setting up a dangerous liability issue for the city if we have employees carrying personal weapons and maybe acting in a way that a jury might at some point find they could have taken other action that was less lethal?
Well,
the city could be liable and taxpayers liable.
And we talked about having insurance for anybody who is willing to carry and exercise their CCW. We can have millions of dollars as a personal liability as well as protecting the city.
But isn't the city self-insured?
Yeah, the city's insured, but if somebody opts to carry their weapon, we would also mandate that they have insurance as well.
Before we go, do you see this coming back to the council? Do you have an idea when, or is it still just in the works?
It's in the works. We're working with the mayor, who has expressed some very appropriate concerns, and so we want to see if we can find some common ground and come up with a policy, because there is no policy in place now.
Councilmember Gary Bredefeld represents Northeast Fresno, and this is his second stint on the city council. He joins us today, fresh off of a legislative victory last Thursday, in which his ban on recreational marijuana dispensaries passed the city council in its first vote. Gary, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. Appreciate the time.
Earlier today, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced a new deadline to end a program that has protected as many as 51,000 undocumented residents living in the Central Valley. He He says he will give Congress 6 months to come up with a permanent immigration fix for an Obama-era program called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, or he will cancel it. DACA is a program that grants protection for deportation and a right to legally work in the country for undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children. Last week, before the decision was made, two Valley Republican congressmen signed on to a letter saying ending the program is a bad idea. Before today's announcement, Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess spoke with one of those Republicans, Hanford's David Valadao, about why he's opposed to the president on this high-profile immigration issue.
You decided to sign on to a letter to the president asking him not to rescind DACA protection for undocumented people who were brought here as minors. Why did you decide to sign on to that letter?
Well, one, I think it's very important for us to get to the base of the issue, and the foundation of the issue is immigration in general. And so we have to fix that and solve that and get it to immigration reform. I don't want him to rescind DACA, not necessarily because DACA is the best policy, but again, it's protecting children here, no fault of their own. And while Congress is not getting to the point of fixing immigration, DACA is the next best thing for these kids. And so allowing them to stay in place, allowing children who came here no fault of their own to continue to work and be productive members of society is, I think, a reasonable approach. But I still think at the end of the day, Congress, the president, have to get to a final agreement on some sort of immigration reform so that we can solve this once and for all.
I'm going to quote from the letter where it says they're paying taxes, receiving driver's license, buying cars and first homes, all of which generates revenue for the federal, state, and local governments. Is the continued presence of these undocumented immigrants on the whole a net positive?
Well, I mean, for kids to sign up for DACA, they have to be productive. I mean, they're very strict on the rules, so if even something as simple as a DUI is a problem for them. So, yeah, those who qualify for DACA have to pass background checks, have to be able to go to school. So they are productive members of society, and I think they are a positive for our economy here locally. So it is something that makes sense. But again, it has to be done right, and we have to pass an immigration reform. It has to be passed so that it can become law the right way.
Immigration reform on the whole has been, I mean, they've been talking about this for a very long time. Decades is right. What's the likelihood that this doesn't just become keeping DACA in place doesn't just become de facto in the long term and the immigration reform just keeps getting kicked down the road?
Well, the problem with the DACA staying in place is literally any president can wake up any morning and decide, this is no good anymore. And that, I don't think, is appropriate for someone someone's future to be hanging on by just the president's whim. I think the reason why we have a Congress and the reason why we have a presidency in the different branch of the government is so that when we pass those bills, they become law. There is an actual process where folks have the opportunity to have input, which is where the legislative process plays a role, and the president signs it so it becomes law. That is the right way to do things so that it's open, it's transparent, and it's secure, so when it affects people's lives at home, those here in the Central Valley and anywhere around the country, they'll feel secure because it is rule of law.
I also saw that your colleague Jeff Denham signed on to the letter as well. The two of you represent big parts of the Valley that have a lot of DACA recipients in them. How concerned are you about those constituents and their families if these protections are withdrawn?
Well, it's obviously going to play a big role in a lot of folks' families throughout the Central Valley. So anything that concerns us, concerns our districts, concerns those who live in our district, is a big deal for anyone in Congress. And so it is something that I do believe can be a real problem for us. And so that's why Jeff and I have both led on this issue.
Would removing people who have DACA status, if DACA is repealed and is no more, is that a waste of resources that could be spent on getting what the president has called bad hombres out of the country?
Yes, I do believe so. Going after kids who are, again, came here no fault of their own, are allowed to work, productive members of society, driver's license, and actually do something good in our communities, and focusing on them versus, and we do have some dangerous people here in the Central Valley. I talked to my local law enforcement, and I've actually seen names and some of the charges brought up against some of these folks. And I think the administration should focus on those who are here, because not only do they do harm to regular citizens, but they especially take advantage of the undocumented population, because they know that the undocumented population would be afraid to call the police or call any sort of law enforcement because of fear of being deported themselves. I think that the president should focus on those who are here to do us harm, and I think it'd be a waste of resources to do otherwise.
Have you spoken to the president, or do you know if he's read your letter?
No, I've never actually met the president.
So he ran on a pretty hardline immigration platform, and a lot of people voted for him because they wanted all undocumented immigrants to be deported. Why should we be surprised that he's considering repealing DACA? I think he was pretty straightforward about that intention.
No, you're right. He did run on a pretty hardline campaign, but he also, since taking office, has made quite a few public comments that he would be willing to work with those who are here who have done nothing wrong. And he's said that a few different times, privately and publicly, and I'm looking for some opportunity there to do what we can, again, to protect kids who have come here no fault of their own, give them a fair shake.
You are a Republican. This is a Republican president. Does it make it, do you feel any uncomfortableness within the party to sign on to a letter that could be in direct opposition to a decision he makes?
No. I mean, I've always done what I thought was right by my district. And sometimes you get a lot, you agree with people in the White House, sometimes you disagree. And if it was President Obama or President Trump, I mean, I've always done what I was supposed to do to represent my district and make sure that I carry that message to Washington and whoever's in the White House. There's going to be times we disagree, but there's no reason why we should let that get in the way of having an open dialogue.
And you have been back in the district for a couple of weeks now. Has anyone brought this up to you?
As far as DACA, yeah. I do hear about it quite a bit. Immigration is brought up all the time, almost every meeting I go to. Even my meetings with my healthcare institutions will bring up the fact that they struggle to bring people in because they're afraid of being deported. And it's a real problem for the healthcare industry, even in the Central Valley.
So in your conversations with people from the district, what are they telling you?
That we need to have a reasonable approach to immigration reform in general. As far as DACA, most people understand that it was not passed into law, so it is not a law. But we need to have legislation to fix this so that people feel secure at home and move on with their lives and start being productive members of society.
And in lieu of legislation, you think that the DACA protections are an appropriate middle ground?
Well, I think that they should stay in place today. I think the president, we have to work to get law signed into place so that we're not relying on, again, something that could be challenged in court like DACA is being challenged now.
We've been speaking with Congressman David Valadao out of Hanford. We appreciate your time today.
Hey, thank you.
And again, those remarks to Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess last week before today's announcement by Attorney General Jeff Sessions about President Trump's desire to end the DACA program within 6 months. That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. Send us an email, talk@kvpr.org, or tweet us. We're @KVPR and @Valley Edition. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Carrie Klein and Jeffrey Hess, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver. I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation. With a new partnership, you can now find C-section and other maternity care ratings for your local hospital on Yelp.